It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome to Money for Lunch. It is good to have you here. And first of all, I wanted to do a shout out to our men and women who are currently keeping the government running during this shutdown. It is it's historic, and we appreciate their patience, their perseverance. As you probably know, there's like 350,000, give or take, plus federal employees that were on, quote, furlough or whatever, laid off during the shutdown. And I believe there's like an additional 300,000 or 400,000 that are working without immediate pay, meaning they'll eventually get paid, assuming the government gets funded, which is going to happen. But bless those people and their families who are really taking a hit. And just wanted to let them know that they are appreciated and that they're appreciated, and to stick in there or stay in there, whatever. Yeah. Continue to be perseverance, persevering. Obviously my lips are wearing out. All right. So let's start with the quote of the day. The quote of the day: the single biggest problem in communication is the illusion that it has taken place. That is by George Bernard Shaw. The single biggest problem in communication is that the illusion that has taken place, George Bernard Shaw. And that goes without saying, this is something that communication affects us all the time. In the boardroom, in the dining room, or the family room, whatever, even in the bedroom. So communication, extremely important. Let's get this party started. Today, I am being joined by Brian Trasher. Brian Trasher is a New Orleans businessman who has helped to bridge the divide that often exists between business and politics. As a senior partner at Gulf South Strategies, a local government relations and business development firm, Brian has worked to give both access and a voice in local and state government to a diverse roster of clients that spans everything from local nonprofit organizations to multi-million dollar corporations on the Fortune 500 list. Gulf South Strategies is also the firm largely credited as the political face that paved the way for Uber Technologies' recent entrance into the Louisiana market. Brian Trasher, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
You bet. All right, so I want to talk a little bit about what you guys help do with Uber Technologies, because, you know, Uber is being tossed back and forth. They're good, they're bad, they're good, they're bad. And they had been kicked out of several cities and I think possibly a couple of states. Why bring Uber Technologies to Louisiana during this, I guess, heated, controversial period?
Well, I guess I should update my bio a little bit, because Uber's been in Louisiana for about 5 years now. But initially, because I have an office in Washington, D.C., I go back and forth a lot. And I used Uber a lot up there, starting in like probably 2011 or so. And it was just, you know, New Orleans being such a big tourist destination, and we were kind of known for having a horrific taxi cab system. I wanted to know why we couldn't have it here, and I was able to get in touch with some of the executives at Uber, and basically they just thought that it was going to be, you know, politically an uphill battle, because New Orleans is such a political town, which is true. But I told him that, you know, look, you know, the right strategy, there's a way to do it. And we took on the taxi industry and eventually got Uber into ride sharing itself into the New Orleans area. And it's flourished. It's done extremely well. And it's actually forced the taxi cab industry to kind of take a look at itself and do better, hire better, more professional drivers, have cleaner and more efficient vehicles. And all in all, it's been really good for public transportation within the region here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting to me because one of the things that you mentioned that, and this is the thing that escapes and continues to escape the taxi industry. You mentioned that you had a good experience with Uber. And for those who use Uber or Lyft, their cars are more updated. The people that drive you speak English really well. And I'm not saying that to be disrespectful. I am an immigrant. I came here barely speaking any English. Oh, I take that back. I spoke no English when I came here. And I have nothing but love and respect for any person who comes to this country and gets to work. And sometimes for those who have ever experienced a taxi in New York, that means driving a cab with no training. And, you know, on one side, I have no problem with that. But the reality is you can't speak the language, you don't know the city, you should not be driving a cab. And interestingly enough, Brian, I was in Vegas and I thought, you know what, it's been a couple of years since I've taken a cab. I want to see if they've done anything to up-level their game. So I took a cab. I am sad to report that they have done nothing. They've actually gotten worse. It was a horrible experience. I'm not going to get into all the details, but you know, the taxi industry can survive. They can make a big turnaround. They're entrenched in some of the best high traffic areas. All they have to do is change the level of service that they bring to the game.
True. Yeah. And look, I will say that, you know, for years I'd used taxis in the Washington, D.C. area, and I really didn't have a problem with. And the only complaint I would have if I had one was that, you know, the accessibility in certain neighborhoods, or if you're kind of in a, you know, if you're kind of off of a busy street in a residential area, you'd have to call a cab on the phone and wait for them and whatnot. They wouldn't be just be kind of passing the street like they do if you're like in downtown D.C. or near the Hill or anything like that, which, you know, again, I don't blame the taxis for that. It's not where their main traffic was. But the thing that really revolutionized, you know, the transportation industry with regards to ride sharing is that it's on demand. It's smartphone based. The driver doesn't know who he or she is picking up, which there was a lot of complaints about, you know, racial profiling. Cabs wouldn't pick up people that maybe looked a certain way. Whereas with the ride sharing app, they don't have any, you know, they're accepting a fare. They're going to pick them up. They don't know who it's going to be, what color they're going to be, what they look like. But you could be anywhere and they would be able to find you via GPS, and you know, you'd get a ride, you know, you'd get a car within 5 minutes or so, and you'd get to where you needed to go. You already knew how much your price was going to be. And the payment was all taken care of electronically. You didn't have to get cash out of your pocket or use a credit card after you get there. It's all done very seamlessly, very efficiently. And that's one thing that I like. In New Orleans, however, in the taxi cab's defense down here, they had been really raked over the coals by politicians for many years, constantly changing regulations, constantly making them upgrade certain things that cost them money. But like you said, it still didn't make them up their game as far as like trying to train their drivers to dress and act more professionally, clean their cars out, upgrade their fleet. It was still horrible. So yeah. The ride sharing industry kind of brought that. And to this day, I will use a cab if it's more convenient for me. But most of the time, I'll use a ride sharing app.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm the same way. I you know, like you, I grew up on taxis. You know, if you're in D.C. or what do you call it, San Francisco or New York, they used to be the you know, a main staple of transportation, but not so much. And it goes to show you, it helps all of us to remember that just because you're the big dog in that market doesn't mean that somebody sooner or later is not going to come by and take your market share away if you don't continue to update your customer service.
Correct.
All right.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, look, it's like anything else. I mean, look at what's happening to the fast food industry in this country. There's a lot more healthier and, you know, better tasting choices in similar price points as far as food. And the younger generation is not going to the McDonald's and the Taco Bells like they did when I was younger. You know, it's just a matter of giving the consumer what they want. And yeah, these politicians have been given ride sharing a hard time. They're also doing it in the short term rental industry, which is another, you know, disruptive sharing economy type industry. But what they're going to find and what they have found is that now that the public is used to it, once they take something away that the public likes, these politicians are going to have to answer for it at the ballot box at election time. So they should proceed with caution.
Yeah. Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. All right. So I was excited to get you on the show. I cannot wait to get the my question answered, and that is, you have a book entitled "Laws and Sausage," and first of all, I love the title because it kind of makes you do a double take, make sure that you're reading things correctly. So, but talk about this. Why did you, how did you come up with this title? What does it mean?
Well, it's not a cookbook, first of all. back in, I think it was 1789, there was a professor at the University of Michigan named John Godfrey Sachs. He was a lawyer and a poet, and he said, he was quoted as saying, laws like sausages cease to inspire respect in proportion as to how they are made. And it's been kind of amalgamized over the years. It's been repeated by folks like Mark Twain and I think Otto von Bismarck. And basically it just says that, look, you know, laws and sausages are two things that people want, but you don't want to see how they get made because you may not want them if you see the process. And it's true. You know, I've been in a professional lobbyist for over 20 years, and I've seen laws get made, changed, and terminated at the local, state, and federal level. And quite honestly, it's not a very appetizing process to see, but it is a process nonetheless, and that's how our republic works.
Yes, absolutely. All right, let's talk about this. You're a professional lobbyist. What type of organizations do you speak to? Who is your target audience?
So I get brought in by a lot of trade associations, especially ones that have conferences up in D.C. where they're planning to do what they call a fly-in. They'll send their members up to the Hill and meet with members of Congress to talk about their industry and you know, any type of laws they want to get passed or regulations that they want to get changed or whatnot. And what it is that, you know, a lot of folks don't realize that anybody, you don't have to be a professional lobbyist, you don't have to know a lot about politics, anybody has the right to petition their government. It's in the First Amendment, the right to petition your government for redress of grievances. And in my book really just kind of talks about how to start, you know, start from scratch, 101, how to identify who your which type of elected official is going to be the right one to talk to pertaining to your issue, how to go about setting up a meeting, how to deal with staff, how to be remembered, how to, you know, basically just go through the entire process of getting your agenda in front of the people that actually make the decisions. And so I go in a lot of times and I'll deliver a keynote on this very subject and just kind of get people fired up and understanding that, you know, elected officials are regular people, just like you and me, just with much, much bigger egos. And you have to know how to stroke that ego and talk in the language that they can understand and present yourself in a way that they'll remember, because they're going to meet with 100 different people a day. And the only way they're going to remember you is if you stand out. And I don't mean by, like, starting a fire in their office, but, you know, there are other ways to do it. And I talk about it in my book.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm glad you said that, because politicians really are like, to me, they're like anybody else, in the sense that they are being courted by, you know, thousands of people. And, you know, just like in any market, it's a mature marketplace. There's a lot of competition. You got to stand out. And sometimes you need a coach or a mentor, or in this case, a lobbyist, to help guide you and get that message heard, right?
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, look, I akin it to when you go to court, you should probably take a lawyer. You know, they say he who represents himself as a fool for a client, you know, and it's not always true in the lobbying business. I mean, there are things that people can get done on their own, but, you know, folks that are professional lobbyists already have the built-in relationships. They have the knowledge of the process. They know their way around the building. They know the staff, you know, things like that. So it's just a kind of like a fast pass at Disney. You know, you can go on your own and wait in line, or you can cut to the front of the line and get on the ride faster.
Yeah, no, I like that analogy. That's great. All right. So let me ask you this. Right now, it is a toxic political climate. I mean, the shutdown is going on, I don't know how many days. I think it's a new record. The president is basically not backing down. The Democrats aren't backing down. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. But it's a very toxic environment. Does that make people more or less likely to seek you out as a speaker, seek you out as a consultant? Talk about this.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it was not that it was planned, but it just turned out to be good timing, because more people are engaged in what's going on, because the president is so good at getting noticed and getting media attention. And because the media hates his guts, and because so many people were absolutely sure that that Hillary Clinton was going to be the president, it was a foregone conclusion. All the pollsters had given the president zero chance of winning, and he won. And whether you wanted him to win or not is kind of irrelevant. He is the president, but
right.
It's because he defied the conventional wisdom. He took on 16 very seasoned, very talented Republican candidates in the primary, and he destroyed them all. And then he took on, one of the most powerful political families in a generation, meaning the Clintons, and he beat them. So he's got a lot of enemies. But having said all that, you know, because of the attention, and because he relishes in the negativity, a lot of people think that, he complains about the news media and the unfair treatment that he gives, but he relishes that. He loves that, because he thinks that, and maybe even with some merit, he thinks that his supporters like him. The more the media hates him, the more his supporters like him. So, but again, it's a toxic environment. Sure. The Congress has never been more divided. The American people have never been more divided. But that opens up an opportunity, for people who want to get involved in the process, to seek out an actual education and some assistance in how to get involved. And I like to think that that's where I come in. And it doesn't matter where you're at on the political spectrum, the left or the right, the Democrat, Republican. My book doesn't really talk about party. It actually talks about, with regards to the political parties, it talks about how they're really irrelevant to the process. I mean, you know, which party decides, you know, who's in control of Congress. Like right now, the Democrats control the House, Republicans control the Senate. The sausage maker works the same. It's just cranking out elephant or donkey sausage, but the process is the same. So it doesn't matter, and I'm happy to. I've had both Democrats and Republicans tell me that they hope the other doesn't read my book because they don't want the other side getting wise as to how to work the system. So maybe that's the best compliment I could have gotten.
Sure, absolutely. You know what? And there is whether you voted for President Trump or not, I think that you have to give him his credit. You have to. There is so much to learn from the way he has persisted, how he has been able to, as you said, demolish the competition. And, you know, again, whether you like him or dislike him, voted, didn't vote for him, to me, that's not even relevant at this point. Look how he is able to handle, as you mentioned, the negativity. Also, I admire his energy. This guy seems to be nonstop. And whether, what's the word I'm looking for? Whether it's accurate or inaccurate, he speaks with authority and confidence. And there's just a lot to learn about how he has conducted himself or how he conducts business in the avalanche of negativity that is thrown at him. So, and some of it I think is self-imposed.
He's his own worst enemy. I mean, look, he could really be a lot more successful as a president. I mean, he would probably argue that he's been very successful, and the numbers might even support him on that. But if he would just kind of tone it down and not be not be so happy to piss off his enemies. You know what I'm saying? Like be a little bit more magnanimous. There's a lot of people who that I talk to every day that don't really have an opinion about him one way or the other, but they're like, hey, look, he's the president. For the sake of the country, I hope he does well. But for God's sakes, could he stop tweeting? Could he stop antagonizing people? And I tend to agree with that, but you have to understand that ever since he was a young man starting out in business, he's always done and taken on projects that people said couldn't be done and gotten them done. And so he's just kind of like he's built his entire life, career, and fortune on defying the odds. And he trusts his gut more than he trusts, any book or any expert. And that's what you have. He's not going to change. He's 72 years old. You know, yesterday he got up in the morning – gave a press gaggle to a very hostile press corps. He was asking him if he was a Russian agent. He flew down here to New Orleans and delivered a speech to a bunch of farmers who you would think might not have received him very well because of the tariffs, but they actually gave him a standing ovation and flew back to Washington, D.C. and hosted the national championship Clemson Tigers. And because most of his staff is furloughed at the White House, he went out on his own nickel and bought a bunch of fast food and gave him a fast food buffet in the White House. I mean, this is a typical day for this guy,
Right.
And he probably stayed up till 3 o'clock in the morning, was back up at 5, and he's at it again on Twitter. You know, I mean, guys, he's just a force that probably can't be reckoned with for better or for worse.
Right. And again, there is so much to learn on from this guy. And one of the things that I appreciate about President Trump is that you kind of know what he's thinking because he has no filter. And of course, that's the same thing that that's hard to like about him, right? That he just, he has no filter, as you're saying. He's just like, this is it. And he will antagonize. But I think that to me, there is that is part of his strategy because, first of all, especially in politics and in quote, in business, there's this thing about being cordial and trying to, get along with everybody. And he has said, hey, poo-poo that, I'm going to antagonize. And the reality is because this is something, an area that he's familiar with, by antagonizing his opponents versus whether it's business or political, it throws them off their balance, and he gets his way a lot of the time.
Yeah, listen, I mean, if you remember in the movie Godfather 3, when Al Pacino tells his nephew, who's played by Andy Garcia, he says, never hate your enemy, it clouds your reason. And
yes.
President Trump tries to make people hate him because he knows it clouds their reason and it throws them off tilt. And he's the type of guy that will seek any initial advantage that he can in a debate or in a negotiation. And they call it Trump derangement syndrome. People just, you know, the people that hate him so much that they just kind of flail their arms wildly and say a bunch of crazy stuff, and they don't really make a lot of sense. And even if they happen to be right, you know, on the right side of the issue, they don't appear to be right because they just kind of appear to be unhinged. And he, that's all part of his strategy. You know, people don't realize that he's kind of a 4D chess player. I mean, this is a guy that, you know, if you read any of his books, you'll see that in one of his first casinos in Atlantic City, he was partners with Holiday Inn. And, you know, I don't want to go into the whole story, but he basically devised a scheme to drive up their stock price to the point where he bought them out of his hotel with their own money. You know what I mean? Like the guy, for everybody that says he's stupid, like, I just laugh because I'm like, you know, whether you want to call it smart or evil genius, calling him stupid, you're doing it at your own peril, because he seems to be outsmarting everybody that's against him so far.
Right.
So I always know when somebody that I'm up against, if they're smart, I treat them like they're smart, because the minute that you let your guard down is when they kill you.
Sure. And I like the way you said that, because look, if you know that those the 15 Republican opponents that he went up against were all laughing at him, were all snickering, they were all calling him stupid or this or that, and now they're still wondering, how did I lose that? What happened? How's it possible? So yeah,
Jeb Bush was the heir apparent to the nomination. He had the family dynasty. He had $300 million in the bank, 2 terms off of being a Florida governor, a big state. He had, you know, Karl Rove. He had everything in place to be the nominee. And he never cracked 3%. And I think President Trump spent maybe a tenth of that budget in the primary to win it. And Jeb Bush was out before his own state's primary. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah,
it's people were just, and there you could just, all over YouTube, you can find videos of both Democrats and Republicans saying Donald Trump will not be the nominee. He will not be the nominee. And then you see him like, Donald Trump will not be president. He will not be president. Now there's people saying that, you know, he's going to be impeached. He's not going to make it to his second term. He's not going to run for reelection. He's not going to get reelected. Just watch. You know, you sit by the bank of the river long enough, you'll see the bodies of your enemies float by.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it is people need to watch this for what it is. Just disassociate your emotions from it and just watch it and learn. And there's a lot of dynamics happening here. Let me ask you this. You've been in the business of politics for how long?
Roughly 22 years.
Okay.
And if you want to start way in the beginning, when I was like 16 years old, you know, we can go back a few more years than that. But getting paid to work in politics, about 22 years.
Okay. So with your experience, knowing what you know, is there any advice or strategies that you can give our listeners on how to effectively communicate with their elected officials, representatives, whatever you want to call them?
Yeah. Never presuppose anything about anyone. A lot of times, you know, an elected official, you might only know them by having seen them on television or in the newspaper or maybe on social media. And just because they take a certain stance on something or they talk a certain way, don't ever think that that's how they are as a person. Always go in with a clean slate and always give people the benefit of the doubt, and they'll do the same for you. If you go in presupposing, you'll end up screwing up the meeting and probably taking attention away from your issue and putting it, making it more about you. Make it about your issue, not about you.
Yeah.
That's the best thing I can tell you. You know, I mean, I'm going back up to DC in a couple of weeks, and I've got some meetings set up with some senators and, about an issue. And, there's a couple of them that are Republicans. I'm going to be meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders, who, almost everybody thinks they know everything about that guy. But, when you're one-on-one, he's a very, very charming, kind of whimsical character. He'll always listen to what you have to say. It doesn't mean he's going to do what you ask him to do, but he'll listen to what you have to say. So just don't ever presuppose about people.
Yeah, and I really, really like what you said there. It's the situation, it's the issue at hand that is, the challenge or the problem. It's not the person. And I think this is
right.
A mistake that so many people make. It's personal. And so just because that person doesn't understand or doesn't agree, you make it about them, and it's not about them. It's about the issue and resolving it. I think that I love that idea that, make it about that, because the more
William Shakespeare said, the play is the thing. It's the play. It's not about the actor, the director, or anything. It's the play, so keep it about the play, not about you and not about them.
Absolutely. No, I love that. I think that's so smart. All right. You say in your book that public protesters are just wasting their time. What do you mean by that?
Well, the problem with a lot of people who join these public protests, they do it out of a sense of selfishness. It's like, it makes me feel better. It makes me feel like I went out and made a difference. But, Martin Luther King said that if he would have marched on Selma, and I'm paraphrasing what he actually said, but if he would have marched on Selma and then turned around and just went home and just relished in the publicity that he got off of it, then there would have been a Civil Rights Act. You know what I mean? So a lot of people they protest and they go home. So if that's all you're doing, then yeah, you're completely wasting your time. Sometimes a public demonstration can be a good starting gun, but if you don't actually get into the halls of government and work the process and talk to the people that can actually that make the decisions, that can actually do something about your issue, then you are wasting your time.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I catch
I like
a lot
that.
Of flack for saying that, but it's the truth. I've been doing it a long time. And that adage has never been proven wrong to date.
Well, and to me, it makes sense because, the one protest generally is not going to fix or do anything. It's like you said, it's great, but you got to commit, you got to vote, you got to really going back to it's about the issue. So you have to really get into it. And yeah, you get involved and you do one protest and yeah, so what? But if you're serious about it, then you're going to commit time and money and energy. And I always tell people, look, if you're not willing to commit time, money, and energy, then it's not that important to you.
Yeah, I mean, look at what happened with the shooting at the Parkland High School in Florida. You had a handful of those kids who kind of became media darlings, like the David Hoggs and all that of the world that were on the cover of magazines and they were all over the news and they were, getting millions of social media followers. And they had this big protest in Washington, D.C. And, all they did was sit there and curse and call out certain politicians and tell them that they were murderers and all this other kind of stuff. Well, then one of the kids who was at that school, who also became an activist named Kyle Kashev, he was not invited to speak at that protest because he didn't agree with the other kids on gun control. And so he said, okay, so he, instead of going to that protest, he went and met with a bunch of members of Congress and ended up getting a meeting with the president in the White House. And I guarantee you, he got a lot more done that day than all those thousands of kids that were out there on the mall protesting and chanting and cursing just to get on TV, because he talked to the decision makers. And those other kids, guess what they did? They protested and they went home.
Yeah. And their enthusiasm died down because
yeah, it was all for one day. It was just for one day. It's just a big show, and there was no follow up. So, and now they, you know, they're kind of struggling to get booked on shows anymore. You know what I mean? Like they're still on social media, but they're not accomplished. There's been no meaningful gun control legislation passed, and really, it's kind of fallen off the front pages, you know, and unfortunately, and I hate to even say this, but it probably won't come up again unless there's another horrible mass shooting like that. But, you know, we could spend a whole entire show talking about the merit of whether or not, you know, gun control is going to stop a mass shooting like that. But you get the point. I mean, these kids very naively thought that, you know, by making a big splash on CNN, would change the world, but it was the one kid who they excluded from the event because he didn't agree with them that actually ended up getting things done.
Yeah, and I think that's a great example, and I think that's not only is it a great example, but it's also goes to let you know that you can use that momentum to do something splashy and not meaningful, or you can use that momentum to do something more meaningful, like get in front of the president. And it's just amazing that young person was able to do that. Anyway, Brian, we're out of time. It's been a blast having you on the show. Looking forward to bringing you back again and catch up with you on what you're working on.
Yep. Love to come back anytime. Thanks for the invite.
You bet. Good stuff there from Brian Thrasher. You can find his book on Amazon.com or wherever good books are sold. And again, the book has a very unique name, Laws and Sausage. As always, my friends, thank you so much for stopping by. The number one thing I take away from our conversation with Brian, by the way, is that you can reach your representative. If you really want to make it about the issue and not about the representative, keep that in mind. But if you really want to make change, you got to roll up your sleeves and get to work. And that's how people like Brian Thrasher, that's what they do for their clients. They roll up their sleeves and they get to work. They have to, you know, there is no straight, easy fix for all the challenges that we have. And if you don't like something, then maybe you're the person that's going to change it. Again, share this episode with everybody you know. Let's help as many people as we can. And remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.